for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. After winning the White House last month, President-elect Donald Trump told 60 Minutes he would appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade and send decision-making on abortion back to the states. It's one of several positions held by Trump, his cabinet, and members of Congress that could change women's access to reproductive health care in America. Here to look at what we're likely to see under a Trump presidency, Beth Reinhardt, national politics reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and Julie Robner, senior correspondent for Kaiser A Health News. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome, Julie and Beth.
Thank you.
Beth, tell us about some of Donald Trump's promises about abortion, women's health care during the campaign.
So he made several commitments to anti-abortion groups during the general election part of the campaign. Of course, we know, and this was pretty well publicized, he talked several times about how he would appoint pro-life justices to the Supreme Court, justices that oppose abortion. He released a list of several potential contenders that, you know, were all well-known conservatives. And that went a long way in sort of appeasing the concerns that anti-abortion groups and also other social conservatives, evangelicals, had about Donald Trump, a guy who once called himself very pro-choice, who's been married three times, who ran casinos, who is not sort of a natural fit with that group. I think the appointment of Mike Pence also went a long way in easing their fears about Donald Trump. But as far as promises, he made some other ones that were not as well publicized. He promised to make what's known as the Hyde Amendment permanent, which is the part of federal law, essentially, that says that taxpayer money cannot go for abortions. And this is something that is reauthorized as part of the budget process. And, you know, anti-abortion groups and some Republicans have been pushing for this to just become something that would be built in.
Permanent,
right. Exactly.
You know, it's interesting because do we know exactly when Donald Trump changed his position regarding abortion? Was it when the campaign began? Was it earlier? Do we know when?
Well, as with a lot of parts of Donald Trump's biography, because he was not running for public office, there are large gaps. So we know that in 1999, when he was interviewed and he called himself very pro-choice, somewhere between then and when he ran for president, he changed his mind about abortion. The moment that happened, I don't think is clear. It's kind of like the debate over whether he opposed the war in Iraq, because unlike most candidates who have ran for president for office, they're asked these questions, you know, pretty regularly. Donald Trump was not regularly interviewed about the issues of the day. He was talking about The Apprentice. So there's a gap in sort of the public record on his views when it comes to abortion. The other promises he made regard legislation that anti-abortion groups have been pushing that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. This was something they tried to do unsuccessfully a couple years ago. And he's also said that he would defund Planned Parenthood if they continue to do abortions, which I think that's big part of what they do. I don't think they're going to get out of that business. And so he will be held also to that promise.
So, Julie Robner, every single time you have a new administration come in, you have threats or promises of changes. Give us a little background history on this.
Well, it's a quirk of the calendar that the anniversary of Roe v. Wade is January 22nd, 2 days after Inauguration Day. I think once it was one day after, because Inauguration Day was on a Sunday. So inevitably, every time there is a change of party in the White House, the new president comes in and usually on that anniversary, which is the first or second day in office, put out a number of executive orders that change policy. The two most common that have flipped every time since Ronald Reagan both have to do with international family planning. One of them is called the Global Gag Rule or the Mexico City Policy. It started in 1984, and when it is in effect, it bans U.S. funding to international family planning organizations that either perform or advocate for abortion. So that includes many that even mention abortion as an option. So that's been in effect. Bill Clinton took it out. George W. Bush put it back. Obama took it out. One expects Trump will put it back. The other one has to do with U.S. funding for the United Nations Population Fund, another family planning group. That was mostly a fight over forced abortions in China. And that went on for some years. I'm not positive that one's going to come back. Most of these other things will have to be done by Congress.
What about sales of over-the-counter birth control pills?
That I've actually been looking at that. That was done by the FDA under some duress, under a court order. So it's not clear how easy that would be to undo, because remember, it was a federal district judge who ordered the FDA to do that.
And what about the so-called morning after pill? Same thing.
Well, that is the morning after pill.
Well, but I was talking about birth control
pills.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was talking about that was done under a court order. Over-the-counter birth control is not yet law, or is not yet FDA policy. It's being done by a couple of states. So it's not clear. That's being done mostly on a state-by-state basis. There's no federal over-the-counter birth control.
Okay. And speaking of done by states, isn't that what Trump wants to do, turn everything back to the states on abortion rights, on how you Planned Parenthood? Is it going to go out of business because of what Trump is saying about turning it back over to states?
This is one area where Donald Trump does line up with sort of what has become Republican orthodoxy in championing state rights. It's also sort of a way to get around responsibility, saying, well, if he has said, you know, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, he said it would automatically go back to states and back to the states. So that allows him to say, I'm not the one taking abortion away. That's a state by state decision. So it's a sort of an end run, I think, for politicians on the federal level.
Truly.
Although a federal ban on abortions after 20 weeks would affect all of the states.
Everybody.
That would
not,
yeah. So there's you know, on the one hand, I think what Trump was saying, and he was correct, is that if Roe v. Wade were overturned, it would go back to the states. But if he's also going to support the anti-abortion cause, he's going to support a number of rather stringent federal policies that would affect all the states. Codifying the Hyde Amendment, for example,
right,
would affect every state.
So let's talk about the Supreme Court and how likely it might be that Roe v. Wade could be overturned.
Well, we know that he's going to have at least one replacement to appoint, but that's not going to be enough to overturn Roe v. Wade. There were five votes, and you know, the most recent landmark decision on abortion was the case involving the clinics in Texas, and we saw five justices agree that those restrictions on abortion clinics were too onerous. And so I think the consensus is that you're going to need another seat, another retirement on the Supreme Court or you know, another passing.
And you've got two potentials for retirement on the court.
Really three. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and Judge Kennedy, who's traditionally been the swing vote on abortion.
How old is Judge Kennedy?
I think he's Justice Ginsburg is 83. I think Breyer is 80. I think Kennedy is 79. It's all right around that. They're all either almost 80 or over 80. So there's some question about. And of course, Justice Kennedy, you know, unlike, you know, sort of committed liberals, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who would probably like to try to wait out a Trump presidency, Justice Kennedy might retire whenever Justice Kennedy feels like it's time for him to retire.
So you don't feel that he has that I'm going to stay no matter what sense.
Well, he was appointed by a Republican, so there's not that sort of incentive to necessarily stay.
Nevertheless, he's taken some other opinions.
Absolutely, he has. I'm just saying that unlike the liberal, the sort of the four core liberals who would be expected to try everything they could not to step down to give Donald Trump an appointment, I'm not sure he can say that about Justice Kennedy.
So the likelihood that could happen in a Trump administration more likely than less?
Yeah, they say elections have consequences. The Supreme Court was certainly talked about quite a bit during the election. It was, I think, a driving force and for a lot of conservatives who voted, somewhat reluctantly for Trump.
Beth Reinhard, she's national politics reporter at The Wall Street Journal. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from two people. One who is pro-abortion, the other who is anti. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. Joining us now by phone is Elise Hoag. She's president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, which is in favor of the right to abortion. Elise, explain to us your concerns about abortion rights under a Trump administration.
Well, absolutely. I think it's important for your listeners to understand, first off, that, from where we sit, this election was in no way a referendum on abortion rights. In fact, Hillary Clinton ran a very unapologetic campaign in terms of women maintaining the right to make our own decisions about how and when we grow our families and having all the tools and services available to do that safely and legally, and yet not a single ad was run against her by Donald Trump and his administration and his campaign or any party committee, because I think that their internal polling shows what we know, which is that the majority of Americans actually support the legal right to abortion. And yet we are disturbed. We're disturbed by his choice of Mike Pence as vice president, who has one of the worst anti-women, anti-choice records in the country. And we think that they very well might move to make abortion almost impossible, if not impossible, to access in this country. And what we know from around the world is that when abortion is hard or impossible to access, the number of abortions do not go down, but the number of deaths and injuries to women go up.
We've talked a lot here about what might happen at the federal level. What are the trends you see at the state level?
We've certainly seen since 2010 not such an increase in anti-choice bills introduced into the state legislature, but certainly an increase in anti-choice bills passing at the state level. In my home state of Texas, of course, which is most famous for Wendy Davis's filibuster, again, it's important to note that they had to go into two special sessions changing the rules to institute the 20-week abortion ban because they couldn't do it through the regular route. We think that, even if not a single other anti-choice law was passed at the state level, so many state legislatures have been hostile that, immediately if there are federal threats, we leave women with no options.
Are there, in your view, certain populations, certain areas of the country that are likely to be hit harder than others by those kinds of changes?
Absolutely. I mean, the populations that will be hit the hardest are the ones that need our support the most. It's the poor women, women of color disproportionately, who have already been hit hard under the current state regime, who will now not have solace through federal protections. And, you know, one of the things that I find shocking is that anti-choice legislators, including Mike Pence, have shown that they are not only interested in eradicating a woman's right to a safe and legal abortion, but they are not helping women prevent unintended pregnancies by making contraception harder to get. They are not making life easier on the 6 in 10 women who seek abortion who are already mothers by having family-friendly policies that they support and helping women take care of the children that they already have.
Now, tell me about what's going on in Texas. One bill that passed last week to require that all fetal remains be buried or cremated. Tell me what that's all about.
I mean, I'm not in the mind of these legislators, but I can certainly posit that what it's about is trying to create a culture of intimidation and shame for women exercising their constitutional right and following their own conscience. It is a way to try and extend, you know, a greater sense of personhood to fetuses, which the country has roundly rejected every time personhood has been on the ballot. But really, it is much like what we've seen in terms of other medically unnecessary laws around abortion, like mandatory invasive ultrasounds and waiting periods, which really just seek to humiliate and shame women. And, you know, the challenge there is that women put a lot of thought into their family planning, and they deserve to do so with dignity. And often you're actually creating more pain for the people that you claim you want to help.
What about the regulation that Vice President-elect Mike Pence signed into law in his home state? I gather a federal judge blocked it from going into effect last summer. What might that have done?
Well, certainly that would have continued the trend in Indiana under Mike Pence, where not only are women actually being punished for seeking abortion, and doctors who already live in a climate of fear would live under more threat and more intimidation, which is an attempt to drive doctors out of doing the work that they know is necessary for women's health. But it would spark even more of a public health crisis that we've seen in Indiana, as the women's health clinics have closed there. And again, Diana, as you said, the ones that serve the most vulnerable populations, the rural women, the poor women, that not only has it actually created consequences in terms of abortion access, but we've actually seen things like maternal outcomes go down and HIV rates spike because these health clinics provide basic health care. And so it's concerning to us that people who claim to care about health and care about women are actually doing policy that creates the exact opposite effect.
In Indiana, there was a bill that would actually criminalize abortion. Didn't Donald Trump say something during the campaign about not only criminalizing the action by doctors, but the women who tried to get abortions?
He did. I mean, one of the most, I think, flashpoint moments that created such significant backlash in his campaign was when he actually said he wanted to punish women who sought abortion. And, you know, I think it's fascinating because a lot of those who work in the anti-choice movement sort of freaked out about that, because what Donald Trump was saying was definitely off script for them, but it was a reflection of what's actually happening. to women in these states. And, you know, it's important to recognize, although it was the sentence was recently overturned, that while Mike Pence was governor, a young, poor woman who was an immigrant named Puri Patel was serving 20 years in prison for what was a home abortion. So women are actually being punished. Donald Trump spoke what he saw out there. And the anti-choice movement would like to actually not have that conversation, because most people in America really do not want women punished in any way. They want women to have all options. And so it's important that we look at the truth and that we recognize that there is a reason that Donald Trump suffered, in the polls after that moment, because that is not what people want in our country.
Elise Hoge, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
And now joining us, pardon me, by phone, is Carol Tobias. She's president of the National Right to Life Committee, and of course that group opposes abortion rights. Carol Tobias, what opportunities do you see in this political environment that we'll have in 2017?
Hi, Diane. Thank you for having me on.
Surely.
I am very excited and optimistic about what the next couple of years could bring. I think the top priority for pro-lifers in this election was the Supreme Court and the federal judgeships, because, you know, we've been passing a lot of pro-life legislation at the state level, and much of it has been overturned by federal judges appointed by pro-abortion presidents. So I think we have an opportunity not only to replace Antonin Scalia with a good justice, but also have an impact on those various levels of district judicial benches.
So at the Department of Health and Human Services, which up to now has really been a stalwart defender of Planned Parenthood, I gather you're hoping to see change there.
Yes, we really are. In some of the states, the legislatures and the governors have enacted legislation or policy to not allow abortion providers, and usually it's directed at Planned Parenthood, to receive tax funding for their services. And under President Obama's administration, the HHS has just kind of bypassed the states and said, okay, Planned Parenthood can come directly to us for reimbursement. And I certainly expect that to end. HHS is also, of course, over Obamacare, which is providing federal tax dollar subsidies for policies, insurance policies that cover abortion. I think that is going to end. So this HHS department will have a huge impact on the future lives of unborn children.
Tell me about the Unborn Infants Dignity Act, what that's all about, and why you feel it's so important.
Well, I think there's probably various names. I'm sure you're referring to something, you know, like you had mentioned in with Elise previously. There are some pro-lifers who are working to get legislation or even statutes passed that would say you have to show some respect to the remains, the bodies of the unborn children who were killed by abortion. I think that is an effort to put humanity onto those bodies. These are human beings that have been killed. Now, my focus and the focus of our organization is going to be to try to prevent that death in the first place. We would rather those children live, that they survive, rather than just, you know, making sure that they are provided a proper burial. But I think it's an effort to show that these are human beings and their lives have dignity and should be treated as such.
I wonder if that wouldn't cause even more pain and really disruption to a family if that rule were enforced?
Well, I think this is something that the abortion providers would have to deal with as to how they take care of the remains. The woman who has gone through an abortion is going to live for the rest of her life with the fact that she killed her child, her unborn child. And I think that, I already know that that is such a tragic impact, has such a tragic impact on the lives of these women already, that I don't know of this next step is going to really have that much more of an impact.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I wonder about Mike Pence, Carol Tobias, and since this election, he is the vice president-elect. Tell me what you think he means to this issue.
Mike Pence is a strong advocate for protecting the lives of unborn children. I think he is going to play a critical role in kind of coordinating between the executive branch, the congressional branch. I have complete trust in him. I think he is a solid individual. He is a solid leader. And I am thrilled that he is going to be involved in a lot of different decisions that that will be made that will have an impact on this very critical issue.
So the other aspect of this is, interestingly, that the number and rate of abortions tallied by federal authorities has actually gone down to its lowest level in decades. So why is regulating them now a priority for Republicans?
Well, the numbers of abortions are down to early 1970 rates. The CDC came out with their numbers showing well under a million abortions per year. That their numbers do not include California, New Hampshire, and Maryland, the states that do not report. But it is down, and that's, I think, a tremendous credit to the pro-life movement in a lot of ways. First of all, making sure that people realize we're talking about human beings. For every abortion that is undertaken, the life of a human being is destroyed. Women are dealing with this constantly. Pregnancy resource centers are there to offer support to women who are, pregnant, but not sure how they want to handle the pregnancy or what they're going to do with their baby.
Well,
I think the pro-life movement has been very involved, but I think but that still means there are almost a million babies every year that still die. That's why we are still working on legislation to try to protect those lives.
I wonder whether the availability, however, of birth control measures and the morning after pill has helped those rates go down.
Well, I think it all contributes, certainly.
And are you in any way opposed to the over-the-counter sale of birth control pills or the morning-after pill?
We do not have a position on birth control or contraceptives. That is going to be a decision that each woman or couple is going to make. Where we would be concerned and, of course, try to stop is any pill that is marketed as a contraceptive but instead ends the life of that new baby after that life has begun. That's where we want to make that clear distinction. And if there is some method that a woman is considering, we would encourage her to talk to a doctor and find out if this is a true contraceptive and it's going to prevent her from getting pregnant, or if it is going to actually end a life that has already started.
Carol Tobias, she is president of the National Right to Life Committee. Thanks for joining us. Short break here, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones as we talk about reproductive rights for women and how they will or could be changed during a Trump administration. First to Orlando, Florida. Hi there, Liz. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Surely.
Well, my question is if we have separation of church and state here in the United States, why are laws being made based on a certain religion? Or what would be the main excuse or the main reason to make abortions illegal other than religion?
Julie.
Well, the argument, and of course, this goes further into contraception also, because particularly Catholicism doesn't believe in artificial contraception. But, you know, the argument that will be made by those who wish to ban abortion are the humanity of the fetus. And they're saying that these are people deserving of constitutional rights, that it's not a religious idea, that it's a constitutional idea. Of course, then the question becomes, when does life begin? And that is really the question, because most very vehemently anti-abortion forces will say that life begins at that moment of fertilization. Well, that would make many contraceptives abortifacients. And we've seen this argument go on and on with the morning after pill, which recent studies have shown probably doesn't act as preventing that egg from implanting in the uterus. It probably only acts by preventing ovulation. So there's this sort of place where science and belief and religion all cross. And that's basically what the abortion debate and the contraception debate are about.
And talk about where Tom Price is. He's the Georgia representative who's going to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. What do we know about him, Beth? What positions is he likely to take?
He's a down-the-line abortion opponent. He's also an opponent of the Affordable Care Act's coverage of contraception. When he was...
Excuse me. Here's what I don't get. If people are opposed to abortion, why would they be opposed to providing pills that help a woman prevent herself from becoming pregnant?
Well, I suppose you'd have to ask Congressman Price that question.
I hope to. I hope to.
I imagine they would say, that the government shouldn't be in that area. But I think you're right. There's some questions there. When Congressman Price was asked once about access, what about women who don't have access to contraception? His response was, "Bring me one." He was dubious of the idea that that there are women who do not, know how or can afford contraception.
What happened?
What happened to him?
Did someone come forward?
This has actually sparked a Twitter handle called #PriceIsWrong,
yeah,
of women who have not been able to afford contraception until the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Because, of course, the Affordable Care Act does not just provide no copay contraception to women in individual plans, but it also requires it for most employer plans.
So he did not believe that there were any women.
Well, that's what he said.
That's what he said.
Yeah, I don't know whether he believed it, but I think he fundamentally believed that women being able to afford contraception was not a problem.
All right. Here's an email from George. What about a basic constitutional consideration? Freedom for women means allowing women to make their own decisions regarding health matters, Beth.
Well, certainly that's the argument that we've been hearing for years from the abortion rights movement, that this is a women's right, a civil right, to have control over her body, over her reproduction. I think that we're going to be having that debate all over again. It was interesting that we haven't heard Donald Trump talk much about abortion or really anything since he was elected. But in that one 60-minute interview, he did talk about briefly about abortion. And he called the what is it, two-year-old or one-year-old marriage equality decision by the Supreme Court, a settled law, but then suggested Roe v. Wade was not and was open to be overturned. He also said, as you mentioned earlier, that women would have to go to other states if Roe was overturned. Well, you know, traveling is already the reality for many women. As Elise Hoag said earlier, you know, if you're in a rural area, if you live in a red state, you may not have an abortion provider in your county. You may have to take a bus or, you know, find some other transportation. And so those hurdles already exist. And so what we have now is sort of this patchwork of red states and blue states, where if you're in a rural red state, it's going to be a lot harder for you.
Julie.
And in fact, that was one of the exact holdings in the case that the court decided last year, which is that there would not be enough capacity in Texas to let women exercise what the Supreme Court still, a majority of the Supreme Court says, is still a constitutional right to end a pregnancy. And because the distances were going to be so long, that was one of the main reasons that they struck down that provision.
All right. Let's go to Eric in Bethesda, Maryland. You're on the air.
Thank you. Two quick questions. The anti-abortion rhetoric, from listening to it, it seems like there's millions and millions taking place every week. And I'd just like some actual figures. And my second question is also anti-abortionists. They seem to be also anti-sex education. I mean, every time they mention one, it seems like they mention the other. They can't counsel women that, gee, if you have sex, child, is it possible?
Do we know exactly how many abortions take place in a year? We heard 1 million.
Right, although that doesn't, as Carol Tobias pointed out correctly, the CDC figures don't include numbers from California because it's not required to report. So both sides actually usually go by the Guttmacher Institute. They do a survey of abortion providers, I think, every 4 years. It is around 1 million. It is down considerably. Most people believe it is down because of the rise of long-acting contraception, that more reliable uses of contraception.
And do we have any idea how many of that million may have been done for medical reasons?
I don't think the numbers are broken down.
They don't break
that way.
Down.
I mean, later abortions after the first trimester are, I think, largely done for medical reasons. I don't know that it's broken down that way. The CDC numbers may be broken down.
And the issue of sex education.
I think what the caller is getting at is sort of this lens of morality that some conservatives are bringing to all of these issues, abortion, sex education, birth control. I think one of the reasons some people oppose the contraceptive provision of the Affordable Care Act is that they see it as encouraging sexual activity on the part of women. You know, if you want to have sexual activity and not get pregnant, like, we don't want to be in the business of facilitating that.
I think one of the many fights that have been fought over the years that I expect to see come back is the fight over federal funding for sex education. It's been mostly a fight over comprehensive sex education versus what's called abstinence-only education, only basically teaching, you know, young people to wait until marriage to have sex. And there's been many, 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 many fights and many, many studies about this over the years. I expect to see that reemerge as a fight.
All right, and let's go to Fayetteville, Arkansas. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I've got a pretty simple one here. Donald Trump, during his interview, had already stated about the Gay Marriage Equality of Marriage Act that the courts have already ruled on it. So why are we even debating on whether Roe versus Wade could be turned over or restrictions can be put on it? I mean, is this just another example of just kind of going back on picking whatever he wants? Does Mike Pence's views really even matter on this? The courts have already ruled. It's a done and decided deal.
many things can be overturned. Roe v. Wade is about to turn 44. But obviously, you know, the right to abortion as defined by the Supreme Court has been changed over the years. And depending on how many, you know, it's pretty clear that there are at least three justices right now. Probably there will be four when Scalia gets replaced, who would, if they got the right case, would be happy to overturn Roe v. Wade. So it's definitely still a live issue.
And very much a vulnerable issue.
Well, if Donald Trump were to get another Supreme Court pick in addition to the replacement for Justice Scalia, yes, it could definitely be vulnerable.
All right, to Ian in Indianapolis, you're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
My comment is just basically a plea to all men, with the exception of, you know, those who are, you know, physicians and OBGYNs, et cetera. Really, I feel the only appropriate opinions a man could ever have on women's reproductive rights is to have none. Particularly, I'm saying this goes double for lawmakers, particularly, you know, being from Indiana, I'm familiar with Mike Pence's horrible track record when it comes to women's rights and reproductive rights in particular. So to have an opinion in the first place, I feel for him is offensive. And two, I would like to add what I'd like to hear you, your panel, and the, you know, media at large to talk about more is the fact that, implicated here is really a widespread misinterpretation of not only certain passages from the Holy Bible, but apparently many holy texts the world over that prevent women, in fact, lead them to, say, in this last election cycle here in the States, they literally, by choosing people like Trump and Pence at the ballot booth, they're literally voting to impose a shrinking, not an expanding, of their own reproductive and other rights.
You know, see, in fairness to abortion opponents, there is the question of the potential growing human life. And, you know, there are, and as I mentioned, different religions view this differently. At what point? I mean, over many, many, many millennia, at what point is it appropriate to terminate a pregnancy? Whether you believe that life begins at that single moment, you know, when sperm meets egg, or whether you believe that perhaps after viability, which is basically currently the law, or somewhere in between, there is definitely an argument beyond the sort of rights of women. And that's why we're still having this fight after so many years.
Here's an email from Sarah, who says the governor and lawmakers here in Texas say they want to protect women and babies, but all they do is pass anti-choice laws. If they truly cared about women and children, they would expand Medicaid under the ACA, provide better public education, make contraception easier to obtain, punish rapists more harshly, jail domestic abusers, and implement other laws that would actually help women and children. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It does seem as though a great many men are in control here.
Barney Frank once famously said on the House floor that abortion opponents believe that life begins at conception and ends at birth. And Henry Hyde, for whom the Hyde Amendment is named, actually took that somewhat to heart, and in some of his later years worked with Henry Waxman, a very liberal congressman from California, to work on infant mortality and early childhood education and some other, to, you know, try to say, no, actually, I do care about these children after they're born. But that's in some ways sort of the exception to the rule. But there are definitely some places where some of these abortion opponents will then come forward and say, yes, I do care about children's health and women's health.
All right. To Chip in San Antonio, Texas, you're on the air.
Thank you. I will very much miss you when you're gone.
Thank you.
And I do appreciate the podcast, so I'm trying to keep track of that.
Good.
My comment is this. If this is about the conveyance of dignity, then where is the dignity being conveyed to the people who have to make the decisions about the termination of a non-viable pregnancy, the people who have lived through the results of multiple miscarriages?
You know, it's such an interesting point, Beth.
Well,
so poignant.
Yes. And, you know, the caller makes me think, you know, we didn't talk in more detail about this potential 20-week abortion ban. One of the reasons pro-abortion rights groups see that as so dangerous is that that is exactly the moment when some women have the ultrasound that very late in the pregnancy, unfortunately, because you have to wait till certain organs develop to see if there are going to be problems. That is the moment when they find out that their fetus is that has some kind of horrible defect. And so it puts women in excruciating positions. And many of the laws that we see on the state level include, and the legislation that passed Congress a couple years ago, do not include exceptions for fetal abnormalities. So you would be essentially forcing a woman to carry to term a baby that may have profoundly profound disabilities.
Or even incompatible with life. The other thing is that the laws we were talking about earlier, the state laws about regarding how you dispose of fetal remains, those are not just apply to abortions. They also apply to miscarriages and stillbirths. So now you're putting on women who are having miscarriages a requirement for them to somehow legally dispose of those remains.
And where's the money going to come from?
Well, I was just going to say that. I think earlier in the show, Elise Hoag talked about, you know, shaming the women. That would be the effect of having those kind of requirements, but it also increases the cost of an abortion, which is already, you know, a pretty expensive procedure.
So right now, where in this country are abortions available from Planned Parenthood or individual doctors, Julie?
Well, they're mostly independent abortion clinics and Planned Parenthood. They're available. Actually, I think it's now a minority of counties, but in major metropolitan areas. I mean, the big divide is really urban and rural right now. In urban areas, it tends to be, abortion tends to be available. In rural areas, much less so.
And have the providers of birth control measures been limited in those same areas?
I think to a little bit less of an extent, because you can get contraception from community health centers. But there's, you know, a question about whether Congress wants to get rid of Title X, the federal family planning program, which has been a Republican target in years past.
Julie Reibner is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Beth Reinhard, national politics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Douglas Bell.